We have a little bit of a double dipping. There's somebody who used to daven here way before my time. He's having a second bar mitzvah. So they have a second minyan, they're doing it there. So I didn't want to cancel this year because I knew that there would be at least some people here. But we'll decide that. You guys are going away. Yeah, so maybe we'll vote. But
some of us stay here.
Eskimo? Why, you're cold? I don't make the temperature. Okay, we're going to start. Everybody should have one sheet. I tried to make it simplified this time so we don't have to go back and forth. It's not always going to work with every shear, but for this week it works. So the sources are integrated within the outline instead of having to go back and forth between the outline and the sources. So once again, we'd like to thank Karen and Jake Abelevitz for sponsoring this morning's Locks and Learn in memory of Jake's parents, Eliyahu ben Abba and Leah bas Avram, Karen's brother, Yoshua ben Shimon Dov, as well as for Eloi Neshama of Mr. Alfrichtig, Tuvia Yaakov ben Svizev Halevi, Nate's grandfather, as well as my grandfather, Ephraim Benyamin ben Svi. May all the neshamas have an aliyah. Okay, so we spoke last week about the sixth Mishnah. We're going to review it in a little bit. We did usually we break down the shiurim into the historical background and then into the classic commentaries. We did the classic commentaries last week, and we're going to do the historical background, which will present to us both an insight into Mishnah Vav and to Mishnah Zayin. So today we're going to be recovering the sixth Mishnah and covering from scratch the seventh Mishnah. So to give a little bit of a background, now this background is important and it's interesting in its own right. Its relevancy to the Mishnah, I would argue, maybe Rabbi Lau would disagree with me, is a little bit of a stretch. So when we get from the historical background to how it applies to the Mishnah, we'll put it in a little bit. But regardless of whether or not you think the historical background gives us insight into the Mishnah, the historical background's interesting in its own right. So if you remember from last week, and if you don't, we will review it. 2 weeks ago, sorry, correct, 2 weeks ago. Last week we had Professor Kohler here. So if you go to the source sheet and the outline, it's a brief background. We're up to the second of the pairs. We're in the area, the era of the Zugot, the pairs. Last, 2 weeks ago, sorry, the pair was the Yossi ben Yoezer, the first pair, and Yossi ben Yochanan. We dated them around the year 167 BCE, and we tied that into the revolt for the Chashmonaim, and I refer you to that shir if you want more about this. Actually, sorry, that was 3 weeks ago. So I refer you back to the shir online if you want to catch up. So that was 167. Now, we're up to the second, but we want to know when the second pair is. So in order to know that, let's look at the third pair, which is Shimon ben Shetach, which we'll get to next week. He, we date around the year 100 BCE. So if the first pair is 167 BCE, and the third pair is 100 BCE, and we're talking about the second pair, so presumably it's somewhere in between those two dates. The problem is that it's hard to present that accurately with the source we're about to see in a few minutes that ties Yehoshua ben Prachya with Jesus, right? So when did Jesus live? So around zero-ish. So it was around a century later. So the sage that we would like to, based on our following of the Zugot, place at around 100, at least, BCE, Chazal, in some places, tie him to a century later. So where exactly was this historically? Whether or not the story with Jesus is historically accurate or not, we can leave up to the historians. For now, we're going to just say we're not exactly sure when these people lived, but it was sometime around this period. Let's assume for now that, let's go with, for putting the Jesus story aside for a second, let's assume it's somewhere between 167 and 100. So where does that put us? So we all know the different Maccabees. So if you look at the source 1b, so we have Judah the Maccabee, his brother Jonathan, and then his brother Shimon, and then Shimon eventually leads to his son Yochanan becomes the leader of that. That's around, again, this time period, around 130 to 100. Later on next week, we'll get to Yanai, who's a little bit later than that. So during Yochanan, during this last Hashmonai that we're talking about today, if you look in B.I., Roman numeral I over there, or whatever that's called. During Yochanan, they gained control of most of the internal part of Israel and even expanded it to its borders. So this is a good time for the Jews in terms of its political dominance. The Hashmonaim were able to dominate, and they were able to gain land, and they were given some level of independence. And it was a good time to be a Jew. The question is, what does that mean in terms of the religious life during this time? Are these people, these leaders, religious exemplars? Are these people who we're going to look up to and say these are people who we want to be? Was Yochanan a good guy, or was Yochanan not a good guy in the eyes of the sages? So it's a little bit complex, and he is a complex character who famously actually goes over to the dark side at the end of his life. So there are some earlier sources where Yochanan the Kohen Gadol is quoted as somebody who does present halacha. He's somebody who's holding. He knows the stuff that's going on, and we quote him. There's a Mishnah that quotes him directly as somebody who knows what he's talking about. The problem is that there's this next source here in Brachos, Daf Chav Tes, Amud Aleph, this is in B2.1, it says, Al tamin batzmachad yom oscha. It's the Mishnah in Perkei Avos in Perek Bey, says, you should not believe in yourself till the day you die. Why should you not believe in yourself till the day you die? Because we have a paradigm for somebody who went over and did bad things towards the end of his life. So Yochanan Kohen Gadol is our guy who we're talking about. Shamash Bakuna Gedola Shmonim Shana, he was the Kohen Gadol for 80 years. Ulvasof Nasa Tzeduki. At the end of his life, he became a Tzeduki, who is sort of the enemies of the regular classical sages. So interestingly, Rabbi Lau does talk about it a little bit, and it has to do with this tension, according to Rabbi Lau, about what the role of the Kohen Gadol is supposed to be. So we all know that Tzedukim were very big into the rituals of the Kahuna, but they were also very big into that the Kohen Gadol should be a political power. And there was, as we spoke about in the past weeks, there was a lot of intrigue and a lot of bribes going back and forth as to who would become the Kohen Gadol. In this time, and this is really an interesting broad point in terms of how the sages viewed the Hashmonaim in general, in this time the Hashmonaim started taking over a lot of power. So not only were they the kahuna, they took on a role of malchus, of royalty. They also took on a role of religious, they wanted to be religious leaders, and there was really too much that they were trying to usurp. They were trying to gain too much power. In the Tzeduki realm, that's fine, right? You could be as powerful as you want, you could be a religious leader. From the sages' side, it's not really the greatest thing in the world. If you look at the next source, just following the outline, it says, this is, the Gemara attributes this to Yanai HaMelech, and Rabbi Lau does talk about how in Chazal, the exact Yanai HaMelech, who was a later king in the Hashmonai dynasty, who we'll talk about in the future, gets sort of the bad rap for everything bad that the Hashmonaim did. So whether or not it was actually Yanai or other kings, he's sort of like the amalgamation of every bad Hashmonai king. That's, we call him Yanai HaMelech. Even though he was a figure, he also takes on more than that. He's like the evil villain. Whenever we want to go against the Hashmonaim, he's who we're going to refer to. So Rabbi Lau argues that even though it says Yanai HaMelech, really the blame should also go to Yochanan Kohen Gadol, and you see that the rabbis, in the context of a broader story, they say Rav Lecha Keser Malchus, Hanach Keser Kahuna Lazaro Shel Aaron. It says enough that you're royalty. Right, you should leave it as that your malucha, the kingdom, should be okay for you. Leave the priesthood to the seed of Aaron. It's like, you can't have everything. You can't have all of the power in every single realm. Okay, we have Paskin that it is too cold in here. Sorry. Thank you. So what we see here is that within the realm, the sages don't like when you have too much power. You shouldn't be the royalty. You shouldn't be the kahuna. You shouldn't be religious leadership all bound into one. We need to split those up a little bit. So the argument is that as a consequence of that, you know, Shimon HaTzadik sort of gets pushed to the side and he gets criticized. It's not Shimon HaTzadik, excuse me. Yochanan Kohen Gadol gets pushed to the side a little bit here. And as a consequence, he sort of goes over to the other side where he's more comfortable in his position of leadership. If you remember, which most of you probably do not, the first shiur that I gave here in Kingsway 7 years ago, the first big shiur, was on related to this topic. The topic was why Hanukkah is not mentioned in the Mishnayos. So if you go through all of the literature of Chazal, you'll find that Hanukkah does not get a lot of press time. There's a few Gemaras here and there, a few pages contrasted to Megillah gets its own. You know, we talk about Megillah's Esther, and Purim gets its own Masechta. Pesachim, all the classic holidays, they all get their, you know, huge press time, and then when it comes to Hanukkah, there's very little relevant there. So we went through a bunch of different explanations as to why that is. One of the explanations is perhaps that the sages weren't so happy with the Chashmonaim. At a certain point, yes, they did great things in terms of saving us and, you know, fighting for our religious freedom, etc. But over time, they sort of took too much power, and they took over, and as a consequence, the sages didn't want to highlight that. There was other explanations involved as well. There's a famous Ramban on this, but we'll save that for 7 years ago.
Wasn't there a segment about the Chashmonaim?
But that's not a Chazal. I mean, the Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2 are not within the corpus of religious...
It's because they limited it to like 30 Sfarim, and they couldn't add one more thing.
You could add what you want to add in if you want to. This room. Again, there's... Maybe it's just this little... There was no room, and we're already done, and that's it, and it's over. But not within Chazal. I mean, there's a difference between Tanakh and between the Gemara. There's always room for Gemara. There's always room for Mishnah. So you could add whatever you want, and there's no limit. You just add another Mishnah. They didn't. They didn't. Why? Again, it's intriguing. This is perhaps one of the reasons that we don't want to highlight the fact that some of these people were not, we don't want to say that these are our exemplars. These are people we want to live up to. Right. So that's all within like this. It's like two pages in the Masechta Shabbos.
Compilation of the Mishnah and of the Gemara by Yehuda Anossi, and he's from the Davenic.
Right, good. So another element of this is that Yehuda Anossi, who compiled the Mishnah, as Laser was saying, this was in the, you remember from seven, if anybody remember from 7 years ago, it's Laser. So Yehuda Anossi came from the Davidic dynasty, and here you have these non-Davidic dynasty people trying to take over the royalty, and as a consequence, he sort of didn't want to highlight them. It's a very fascinating, interesting discussion. It's a little bit of the historical background. There's a lot more to talk about. Take one more question, then we're going to move on to the Mishnah, and we'll see how this perhaps plays a little bit of a role into what these sages have to say in their message in the Mishnah. Yeah.
Good evening, Rabbi. I just want to remind you.
We're live.
The interesting thing is that this last source...
Was that just to get on the tape? Was that... Anybody else have anything? I'm just kidding. Yeah, thank you.
I used to mess up. Says to let the crown of royalty suffice you, right? But really, he was the Kohen first. He was, this, if we're talking about Yochanan, I don't know about Yanai, but if we're talking about Yochanan, he was a descendant of Aaron. It should be the other way around.
Right, so that's
the crown of Kahuna suffice you, royalty. Right,
so that's a good question. In the context of that story where that comes up, it makes more sense because he's pushing himself a little bit too far. And Yanai is a little bit different also because there were some questions as to Yanai's, where he came from. There was some intrigue and some interesting stories as to what his lineage was. But it's a fair point. I only brought this source as a broader point that they're doing too much. Whether it should be this or that or whatever, what should be primary or secondary, this is why there was some pushback, presumably. So now let's jump into the Mishnah. So that's source number two, reviewing Mishnah Vav and then reading Mishnah Zayin. According to Rabbi Lau, and there are others who don't go with historical context, who put these two Mishnahs together as a sort of like a point-counterpoint. So Mishnah Vav says, Yoshua ben Prachya ben Itai Arbeli Kiblu Mehem. So this is our next set, our second pair, the Zugot, Yoshua ben Prachya ben Itai Arbeli. They received the tradition from those that preceded him. Yoshua ben Prachya Omer, what did Yoshua ben Prachya say? Aselecha Rav, make yourself or get a rabbi, Knelecha Chaber, acquire for yourself a friend. Vevedan is kol adam lekaf schus. You should judge everybody the scale of merit favorably. That's what we spent most of 2 weeks ago talking about. Mishnah Zayin, Nitai Harbeli Omer. So Nitai Harbeli says, Harchek mishachin ra, move away from a bad neighbor. Val tit chaber l'rasha, you should not connect to an evil person. Val tit ya'esh min ha'puranut. So there's a question, how do you translate this? Let's see how they do it here in the Sansino translation. Neither do thou abandoned faith in retribution. Al titya'esh. Titya'esh means yush, means to give up. Don't give up hope, min ha'puranut, from retribution, from some sort of suffering. So you would want to read that, and we'll talk about this at the end. I don't know how you would want to read it. Well, we have to be careful not to read our own things into the Mishnah, that when things are going bad, don't give up hope. It's a nice way of reading it, but that's not really what it means. According to most commentators, it means that don't forget that bad things can come, right? Don't forget that, you know, if you think that everything's going well, just in a split second, it could all go bad. It's more of a negative message than a positive message. Within the context of the Mishnah, sort of makes sense. We'll talk about that towards the end. For now, let's set up as a contrast between Mishnah Vav and Mishnah Zayin. And then we're going to see a little bit more of the historical background. We're going to get to the Jesus story right now. Source number three, it's a Gemara in Sanhedrin. So this is a Gemara that was edited out for many centuries for obvious reasons, and then was put back in by various editors later on. But this is, it seems to be, it is an authentic, original Gemara. So the Gemara says, I have here just the English translation for you, 107b, when King, source number three, when King Yanai slew our rabbis, Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya and Jesus fled to Alexandria in Egypt. So they run to Alexandria. When peace was restored, so later it got better, Shimon ben Shetach, who we'll meet next week, sent this message to him. From me, Jerusalem, the holy city, to you, Alexandria, in Egypt, O my sister, my husband is dwelling in your midst, and I am desolate. So he quotes this pasuk, basically sends the message, come back from Egypt, come back to Jerusalem, or come back to Israel, everything is safe now. Okay, so Rabbi Yeshua arose and came back, and he goes back to Israel, lodged in a certain inn where they paid him great respect. He said, how beautiful is this aschanya, this inn or inn hostess? He, Jesus, said to him, my master, her eyes are narrow. Right, so Yeshua says something nice about this woman, and Jesus says, no, her eyes are narrow. What that means, there's probably a lot of symbolism behind there. We're not going to get into that now. Yeshua responds to him, wretch, he rebuked him, are those the thoughts that occupy you? He sent forth 400 horns and excommunicated him. Later, the disciple Jesus came to him repeatedly pleading, receive me, but he paid no heed. So Jesus tried to do tshuva, Rabbi Yeshua didn't want to hear any of it. One day when Rabbi Yeshua was reciting the Shema, he, Jesus, came before him. He intended to receive him. So now Rabbi Yeshua is saying, okay, now it's time you could come back. But he motioned to him with his hands. I don't know exactly what he did. Maybe he went like this. But the disciple Jesus thought he was sending him away, rebuffing him again. So he went and set up a brick and worshipped it. So that's where it all went wrong. Rabbi Yeshua said to him, repent, but he answered him, I have received this tradition from you, that he who sins and causes others to sin is denied the opportunity to repent. End of pretty fascinating, a little bit crazy out there story, that here you have, Jesus said something, Rabbi Yeshua didn't like it, excommunicated him, tried to do tshuva, originally didn't take him back, and now when he tried to take him back, Jesus misunderstood what was going on, and then history has unfolded since then. Again, whether or not this is exactly historically accurate as to what happened, I'm not going to say yes or no. We don't have to look at every single story in the Gemara or in Chazal as historically accurate. That's not a position that I take. Professor Kohler last week, I think, presented a similar opinion. I think that's pretty... I mean, it's so. What's the message? So keep going. Go to the next column over here. So this is the message. What is the message? This is the message that they learn from this. Let the left hand reject, but let the right hand draw near. So it says small docha, v'yamin mikareves. So you should push away when somebody's doing something that you want to rebuke, something you don't like. You should push away with your left hand, but you pull back with your right hand, presumably the right hand being stronger. So you push away a little bit, but you pull them back even more. That's the message of this saying. But the Gemara's comment says, not like Elisha, who thrust Gehazi away with both hands, instead of the pushing and pulling back with one. So that was a critique of Elisha. And not like Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya, who rejected Jesus of Nazareth with both hands. That's the takeaway. The takeaway is that Rabbi Yeshua was wrong here. When you have somebody who you want to rebuke, who you think is evil, I don't know, really, really bad. Gehazi was not a good guy. You know, Jesus, I'm not sure what the background to the story is, what he was before, but apparently he was a student. Don't push him away with both hands. Push with the left, bring to the right. Dr. Polkovitz, whenever he quotes this idea, he likes to say that what happens if you could visualize what happens when you push somebody with your left and pull them back to the right? Where does that person go? Well, he goes in a 180. You're turning him, right? So you're putting him in a different direction. That's how you get people to change. But if you push with both hands, then bad things come away from that. Yeah.
Love him more.
What was that? Baal Shem Tov. Right, love him more. So again, this is a broader Hasidic idea, which we spoke about 2 weeks ago in terms of the, even when it says, we're going to make this point directly in a second after I get to Barry's point, but when we say in Yeshua ben Prachya says, judge everybody favorably, so we had a debate, does that mean even wicked people, or does it mean only good people? So we argued from a Hasidic perspective that it means everybody, even wicked people. We'll get to that in a second. Yeah.
In the Medrash Rabbah, Baba Rabbah, I think I got this right. The left hand represents Midas Hadin, and the right hand Midas Harachim, so that if the left hand is pushing away, you can't judge this person so strictly. It should be more
right.
Merciful.
Okay, so just repeating it for the tape, Dr. Panzer said that if the left hand, quoting Rabbi Wallman for the Medrash Rabbah, the left hand represents Midas HaDin, so you push away a little bit, but the Midas HaRachamim is the right hand pulls him back even more. Okay, so now let's make that connection between this historical story, or at least semi-historical story, with the Mishnah that Rabbi Shuvan Prachy says. Flip the page over to source number 4. This is taken from, Rabbi Lau quotes it, that's a message from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Lubavitcher Rebbe says, source number 4, and the explanation is, the Talmud intended to warn even against this kind of rejection perpetrated by Yeshua ben Prachya, for it is clear that when dealing with Yeshua ben Prachya, it is inconceivable that he was motivated by personal considerations and the like. Furthermore, even after having rejected him, he made an attempt to bring him near. Nonetheless, we should be wary of this kind of rejection. So the first point is that Yeshua ben Prachya wasn't a bad guy. He wasn't a bad teacher. He was motivated by good intentions. But even then, it was still a mistake. And here's the kicker. After Yeshua ben Prachya saw the consequences of this conduct, he stressed the teaching of judge every man favorably. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe is putting this statement in Pirkei Avos as a consequence of his learning from this story, that I shouldn't have judged him unfavorably. I shouldn't have pushed him away too hard. Even somebody like Jesus, judge favorably. Again, that doesn't mean, as we spoke about, all the caveats as to how we have to protect ourselves from evil. There are bad things in the world. There are bad deeds in the world, and how we have to stay away from that. Yes, but in terms of the person, no matter who they are, no matter how extreme, smol docha, yeah, push them away a little bit, but you mean mikarevs, you gotta bring them close. Nobody, apparently, is bad enough that we completely reject them, that we completely push them away. Now, yes?
I just wanted to say something that my mother always taught me. She always said, you know, if you give a pot, you have to give a glass. If you give a glass, you have to give a glass. And that's the same thing, meaning, you know, if you hit someone, or not physically hit someone, but you have to, you know, you have to be warm and kind as well. If you're going to punish somebody, let's say educationally speaking, you have to punish somebody, but you have to be kind to them and sensitive.
Right.
As well.
Yeah, I mean, that seems great. That seems to be the message here. Again, you could have made the argument that maybe there are some people or there's some things that you just like, I can't deal with that. Get out of the school. Get out of this community. Get out of everything. Again, I'm not making broad policy statements in general, but the idea here is that We should be very, very careful before we do any of that. And the message that Rabbi Shimon Prochas seems to be saying, the way we're framing it, is that no matter what it is, push away a little bit, but bring him back. And there's nobody that we should judge completely unfavorably, judge the whole person, as we said last week. It's kol ha'adam, as the Sfas Emes said, l'kaf z'chus. Well, from the story, it seems that this is before this story and the pushing away of Shimon Prochas caused him to worship a brick, whatever that means, and then eventually led to everything else. Again, historically, I'm not sure, but this is the story presented here. Okay, now pulling this all together, go to source number 5. This is how Rabbi Lau concludes this section. Where he talks about first the whole Maccabee stuff that we spoke about, the Chashmonaim, and then he talks about this piece with Rabbi Shua ben Prachya and Jesus, and he sums up the whole chapter with the following paragraph, source number 5. It seems the dispute, so he pins source Mishnah 6 and 7, Rabbi Shua ben Prachya and Nitai Arbeli, which we reviewed a few moments ago. So he says that it seems that the dispute between Yeshua ben Prachya and Nitai Arbeli revolved around the question of how to confront misfortune and calamity. Nitai Arbeli's policy, this was the second Mishnah, was understood as a guideline. In a world in which evil is rampant, one must seek fortification in the place of refuge, remote from the centers of influence. That's why he says, stay away from evil, don't connect to a Russia. Right? Get far away as possible. Isolate yourself. In contrast, the view was countered by Yeshua ben Prachya, the Mishnah 6, the first Mishnah we reviewed, who taught that with the help of proper rabbinical guidance, right? So you need the Aseh Lecha Rav and strong attachment to friends, the Aseh Lecha Chaver, as well as searching for the good in oneself and one's surroundings, one can guide each individual in the world as a whole in the correct path. This was his revised teaching acquired in the wake of his failure with his pupil, a critical juncture in Rabbi Yeshua's philosophy. That's how he pulls all of this together from the historical context into understanding the Mishnah. What I want to do now is go to some of the more classical commentators on the second Mishnah, on Mishnah 7, on this, which we can review if you want on the first side of the page. We'll read it again. If you go to the first side, source number 2 is both Mishnayos. We did the classical commentaries already last week on Mishnah Vav. We just did the historical background for Mishnah Vav and Zion. And now we're going to do the classical commentaries on Mishnah Zion, which we'll read now. Nitai Arbeli Omer. Nitai Arbeli says, Harchek Mishachin Ra, stay away from a bad neighbor. Va'atit Chaber L'Rasha, do not connect to an evil person. Va'atit Te'esh Min HaPuranut, don't despair, meaning don't forget that eventually there will be some level of retribution. Okay, so flip back to the second side, and here we go for the messages in this Mishnah. So number 6 here is the connection to the last Mishnah. So as we saw, Rabbi Lau connects both Mishnayos together, and there's some of the more classical commentators as well who connect both Mishnayos together. The Gei Chizayon connects them as one is a Sur Meira and one is an Ase Tov, meaning, if we plug it back in, so what's the Sur Meira? So Nitai Arbeli is telling us, stay away from bad. What are you staying away from bad? You're staying away from the bad neighbor, the Russia, etc. So that's the Sur Meira. That's one aspect, not as in machlokas, not as a dispute. He says you need both of these. You need to stay away from bad, but you also need to approach and attach to good. Aseh Lecha Rav Ukneh Lecha Chaver. So the Gei Chizayon puts them as not a contrast, but as two parts of a whole. You need to both connect to the good and stay away from the bad. The Medrash Shmuel says exactly what we didn't say a few minutes ago, and says that the reason why these two Mishnayos are connected is to make the point that you should not judge wicked people favorably. Again, I'm not trying to whitewash or pretend that there are not people who said, most classical commentators said that when it comes to a Russia, you should not judge them favorably. You shouldn't, right? We gave more of a Hasidic background as to you should include everybody, etc. The Medrash Shmuel takes that more classic approach and says that's why these two Mishnahs are pinpointed against each other. We just finished off saying, judge everybody favorably. Nitai Arbeli comes says, hold on a second. If he's a Rasha, stay away. You don't have to judge them favorably. Make a split. Okay, so that's, again, that you don't have to read the Mishnayos that way, but that's how the Medrash Shmuel reads it. So let's talk about bad neighbors and wicked people. So a few bullet points taken from the Sefer that I've quoted to you in the past, the Masifta, who collects dozens and dozens of commentaries on Pirkei Avos throughout the generations. So, you know, one of the themes that I picked up on was, you know, keep this in mind. Bad, don't live next to bad neighbors. Keep this in mind when you're buying a house or you're renting an apartment. See who your neighbors are.
You go to the door and ask them, are you bad or not?
Yes, you got to ask them if they're a shine. Now, listen, again, there's nuance here, but the main point is that you should know when you're living in a neighborhood, when you're choosing a neighborhood, what type of neighborhood are you living in? We'll let the application of that to, you know, you could take that on your own. But that's one sort of takeaway message. Now, the question is, what type of bad? It's such a global statement. Stay away from bad people. What does that mean, bad people? So the two main approaches you could take here is that, you know, does it mean bad bein adam lamakom or bad bein adam lachaveiros? So you could have some really sweet and nice people who can be great neighbors and awesome neighbors, but they don't keep kosher, or they don't keep Shabbos. They're not from, they're not Jewish, whatever it is. So is that something we should stay away from? Or is it if they're like robbers and stealers and deviant and devious people, that's who we should stay away from. So it's a machlokas as usual. Rabbeinu Bachaye says bad means whether he's Rasha ben Adam Mamakom, Rasha ben Adam Chavero, and there is caveats and nuance here. We shouldn't, right? So again, as the example that I spoke about last week, so the guy doesn't take his garbage out on garbage day, right? So does that make him a Rasha? And so there's things that we might not like about the person, that doesn't make them wicked. So we got to be careful as what we call, how we label people wicked and not. But let's take a classical, you know, doesn't do mitzvos or does averos b'farhesia in public. And then you might have to add the caveat, they grew up religious and then went off of there, because there's another sort of a bigger, broader point. If somebody just doesn't know any better, what are you supposed to do about that? So that's another caveat here that we might have to take into play. But before I get to your point, Fred, in contrast to Rabbeinu Bachaye, the Rashbeit says, no, it only is talking about ben adam lechavero. So if he steals, he lies, he tricks people, etc. Because why? Because those are the things that we want to emulate. Right. Ooh, that guy gets away with stealing. Like, maybe I should learn from him. But it's not kosher. Like, I don't really care about that so much. It's not gonna be a taiva for me. Again, so whether or not how you categorize which is in which category, I think the main point is that if you're gonna be around, forget about neighbors. It doesn't have to be where you live. Who you hang out with, who you associate with. If you're gonna hang out with people who are going to entice you, whether knowingly or just from their modeling this other behavior, that's. Stay away from that. That's not good for you. Now, it gets more complicated. I understand. You can't always choose where you're going to live. You can't always choose where you're going to work. You can't always choose who your family is, right? What about family? Let's say my family is the quote-unquote Rishayim, and I still have to, you know, do I have to? That's a very interesting question. At what point do you say that my family is so egregious? I don't know what that level would be. Let's say they are stealers and robbers and crooks and thieves and whatever. Do I have to honor a parent who does that? Right? Present company excluded, obviously. I'm just kidding. Bad comment. But the point here is that at what point do you say, like, no, this is who I'm stuck with, right? This is my boss. What do you want me to do? Lose my job? Maybe. I don't know. If your boss is influencing you in a bad way, at what point do you say, like, no, I'm not gonna go along with this, right? My neighbor moves in. Do I have to move? So this is not simple. It's easy to make sort of these broad statements, stay away from a bad person, an evil person. When it comes down to practical life things, it takes it. You need people to help you out with these decisions. But these are things that we should be thinking about, and there is nuance, obviously.
But he actually didn't say you have to stay away. He said stay away. It's like a code.
Right.
And I would say don't seek those kind of people.
Right.
They're there, you can't help it, but don't go looking for them.
It's assuming that you're not looking specifically. I'm not looking to join the mob. But what happens if I buy my house and it turns out that my next door neighbor is a mafia cop?
Yeah,
well,
oh, that's good. We know that.
Right. So good. So these are all, again, one of the things that I'm trying to do in all these shiurim is bring up issues that I don't necessarily have complete resolutions to. These are just things that we need. These are guidelines that we need to think how to apply them in our own lives. There is the Meiri, just the last point here, says that there's two aspects to this in terms of not associating with Rishayim or bad neighbors. Is that both so we don't learn and that we also don't get hurt. Right? So if you have bad neighbors who are going to hurt you, then you should probably stay away for your own sake. It's just good advice. Right. So, okay. that's just a little bit on that. I want to make a few more points before we end. I know it's getting a little late. We started late, obviously. But let's do that big piece in the middle. We're going to hold to the last part. So skip that Medrash Shmuel there and go to the Be'er Avos. So it's the next big bullet point down there. He says that, what does it mean that you should, you know, stay away from bad neighbors? He says, you shouldn't be a bad neighbor, right? What does the statement say? It says, harchek mishachen ra. He reads it as, you should stay far away from being a bad neighbor, right? So that's a good point. And then the Mili de Avos has a counterpoint here where he says, harchek mishachen kama ra. If you stay away from your neighbors, that is bad. Right? Again, there's nuance here. This is the opposite point here. But maybe let's assume the neighbors aren't evil. So I don't know if you would say this if the neighbors are evil. That's a whole. There are commentators that deal with this. So what about an Aaron HaKohen, who we have sources who he approaches evil people in order to try to change them? So is that our job? Do we feel confident enough to be able to do that, or do we save that for people who are more sure of themselves or more that they won't get influenced by other people? But here, just a general point. Harchek mishachen. If you stay away from your neighbors, that's not a good thing. You should be neighborly. You should be. If somebody moves in the block, you should bake them cookies. You should, you know, you should go over and say hello. These are things that you know, good neighbors are good. This is something that's a value. What?
Welcome to Kingsway.
Right. Okay. So before we're going to get back to that point of the Medrash Shmuel, I just want to go to this last point here: the Al Tityayesh Min HaPuranus. So. Again, the two ways to read it is that the main way that most commentators read it is: don't forget, bad times are coming. As a reminder, what would be the message here? Again, so it all flows from the beginning of the Mishnah. Bad neighbors, bad Rishayim. That's enticing, right? So what's the reason why I should stay away from them? Because there's going to be consequences. So don't think you're going to be okay. You see they're having a great time. You see that their life seems to be awesome, right? Just fast forward till the end when they get arrested or they get caught doing whatever they're doing, and then their life goes to pieces. Right, so Al Titesh Merapar, don't think that everything going on over there is so awesome. There's going to be, whether practically in Olam Hazeh or in the future in Olam Haba, there's consequences to our actions. There are some commentators who say that it means that if you're going through some bad times, don't despair. Things are hard. Life is tough. Al Titesh Merapar, don't despair. Don't give up hope when things are going bad. The Jewish pessimist versus Jewish optimist. Right, so it's a Jewish pessimist. Things couldn't be any worse than they are. Jewish optimist? Oh, yes, they can. Right? So that's basically what this is. Like, things could get worse. Whatever good you think is going on, things could get worse. It's not a bad thing to remember that. I quoted to you the Gemara in Brachos, which says that, let's say, and this is going to lead into that last point that we skipped, what happens if you're enticed to sin? Right. So again, let's assume in the context of the Mishnah, you have a bad neighbor. Things are going, you know, you have a bad influences. So you're going to be enticed to sin. Amar Rabbi Levi Bar Chama, Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. So, la'olam yargiz adam yetzer tov al yetzer hara. You should always try to incite and try to, be a good definition of yargiz.
You should make angry.
Right, maybe make angry. Right. Get excited. You should always get your Yetzer HaTov, sort of excite, get some passion and emotion involved over your Yetzer Hara. Shenemar rigzu v'al tichtov, right? Get some passion and you won't sin. But a lot of times, if you think about it, if you sort of take the two voices in your head and you have, you know, your little angel on one hand and the little devil on the other shoulder, right? So the enticing one is like, yeah, that's awesome, you should do it. This passion, this emotion, trying to get you to do bad things. And then like the good guy is like, yeah, you shouldn't really do that. And then like the bad guy like punches him in the face and he disappears, right? So the way we conceptualize our Yetzer Hara and Yetzer Tov, the Yetzer Hara is very powerful. And the Yetzer Tov is a little weak little guy maybe with a beard and a cane, right? And the Yargiz is that, no, you got to build up, you know, go send that guy with the beard to the gym. And get him built up and give him some passion, give him some emotion so that he can beat in this war between the Yetzer HaTov and Yetzer HaRa. He can have a fighting chance. So Rigzu Bal Techto. Im Nitzchol, so let's say that works and you're able to create this Yetzer HaTov that's stronger than the Yetzer HaRa. Mutav is great. Vim Lav, let's say it doesn't work. So what's the next step? Yasuk B'Torah. Learn Torah. So if you're enticed to sin and you can't just get that Yetzer HaTov to shut
shut down that Yetzer Hara, go to the Beis Medrash, open up a Sefer, try to learn some Torah. Shenemar Imru Bilvavchem. So the next part of the pasuk says you should recite in your heart, meaning recite Divrei Torah. Im Nitzchu, if that works, Mutav, great. Vim Lav, if that doesn't work, Yikra Kriyashma. Recite Kriyashma. That should remind you that God is, you know, one, etc. It should give you some emunah, some faith. That should help you stay away from the sin. Shenemar Al Mishkavchem. Next part of the pasuk says, while you're lying down, which was a reference to Kriyashma. Im Nitzchu, if that works, Mutav, great. Vim Lav. So now you've tried all these stages. You've tried to talk down your Yetzer Hara. You've tried to learn Torah. You've tried to say Kriyashma. And still that passion for the Yetzer Hara is still within you. You still want to sin. What's the last resort here? Vim Lav, Yizkor Lo Yomemisa. Think about death. This is not forever. Al Titya'esh Min HaPuranut. There's an end here where there's going to be some level of retribution, and whatever passion you're feeling about now, when you're on your deathbed, believe me, it's not going to matter anymore. Right? So the Gemara encourages us, and this is really big in different philosophies now, it's common in a lot of places, that people have daily reminders of death. And I've heard a few people, they have these calendars, basically counting down, predicting how long they're going to live. And it counts down your hours. Now, it sounds crazy because we're afraid of death, but that's very, right? So it could be depressing, but it could also be very, very inspiring.
Liberating.
Right? It's liberating. Yeah, I'm going to die. We could fake it. We could pretend it's not going to happen, but it's going to. And if we remember that, it could inspire us to not sin and encourage us to do good. So with all this in mind, let's jump back into the last source that I want to do, this Medrash Shmuel. The Medrash Shmuel says, what is a reference to bad neighbor, Shachin Ra? So we've been talking about in the general sense, an actual bad neighbor. Medrash Shmuel says it's talking about what? Who's your bad neighbor? Your Yetzer Hara. Your Yetzer Hara is your bad neighbor. Within us, we are we. The I is not the Yetzer Hara. Let's hope it's the Yetzer HaTov. And then there's a part of us that lives with inside of us that's called the quote-unquote Yetzer Hara, how we understand what a Yetzer Hara is. Actually, at some point, I want to give a shir on that. I found some amazing sources on this, sort of give a broad overview of what the Yetzer Hara is. We conceptualize it as part of us. Is it internal? Is it external? Is it, is it psychological? Is it mystical? How to understand the Yetzer Hara is a fascinating shir that we'll do in the future at some point. For now, we're just going to leave it as what the Medrash Shmuel says, that the Yetzer Hara is the Shachin Ra. He's the bad neighbor within us that we have to stay away from. So I want to read a few sentences inside as to how he says this. It's an old Rashi script. If you can't get it, just listen to the translation. Second line here. Hakavana ki yaduahu ki ein shachin karov lo la'adam ki Yetzer Hara. There is no neighbor that is as close to a person as the Yetzer Hara. Shehu besoch me'av. He's in your gut. Shel Adam uvecheko yishkav aliz, he's sitting in your lap. Va'alav hisir ha'shalem hazeh sheyisrache ka'adam me'ashachin. Right, you should stay away from this bad neighbor. The inyan harachak yeh she'im yavi liado yitzro haras. Let's say he knocks on the door. The Yetzer Hara knocks. Right, he wants to borrow something. Right, he wants to get you to sin. So Yetzer Hara davar avera she'inatzel kitzvi miyad. So you should run away. Vistrachik mimenu. Don't answer the door. Harchaka gadol, or stay really far away. Ki bezeh yitztak heitev loshon harchaka shekvar ba aver liyado vikrova etzlov utzarech laharchik asma mena. So step one, stay very far, run away. But now, we're not done yet. V'amar od v'al tischaber l'rasha. Don't connect to an evil person. Now again, evil here referring to as the Yetzer Hara. She'im nizgaber yitzchah ahara alav. So let's say it won. Your first step is to run away, but let's say you didn't run away. Let's say the passion is in you to sin. You couldn't really fight it. I think it says kocho, ala pach. So it's a really strong, that's the way I'm reading it, assuming it's not a typo or there's a letter missing. It was really hard. You lost the battle in terms of the passion. The passion is there. So then he says, "Al tischaber ata elav." You should not connect with it. And I want to make this a psychological point for a second. So there's a new recent type of therapy. It's called ACT, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. And one of the main ideas of ACT is as follows. We have lots of thoughts in our brain. We have lots of urges. We have lots of desires. right? And one of the ways we get into trouble is when we tischaber, when we fuse, in the words of ACT, our thoughts and our actions. And when we think that a thought that I have is automatically true, and then I have to act on it, right? So if I'm, let's say I'm anxious, and I'm thinking that something bad is going to happen, all of a sudden, when I have that thought, I'm thinking like, yeah, that bad thing's going to happen, right? Or if I think, let's say I have thoughts that say I'm a bad person. So I think that thought is true. I fuse my identity with that thought, what they call cognitive fusion. Any thought I have, I think is me. That is I. So we have all of these negative, bad, terrible, awful things that fly through our brain, and we say that is me. And what ACT tries to do, as one of its main core principles, is what's called cognitive defusion, is that we work to separate your thought and yourself. Your thought is not you. Just because you think something doesn't mean that's who you are. Just because you think something doesn't mean you have to act on that thought. And if I don't think I'm reading too much into this, that seems to be exactly what the Medrash Shmuel is saying in terms of the Yetzer Hara. Al titchaber l'rasha, if you have that passion, the thoughts, the feelings, the urges are going through your body. You want to do something. So we have this cognitive fusion. We think that once I have the urge, like I can't do anything about it. That's me. That's who I am. That's what I have to do it. And what he says is, no, you need to diffuse that. And this whole idea of taking the Yetzer Hara, and that's what Chazal are doing to an extent. We're saying the Yetzer Hara is not you. He's a neighbor inside of you. Those evil thoughts that you have to depersonalize them. They're just thoughts. That's not your identity. That's not who you are, and you don't have to act on it. So the Al Titchaber L'Rasha means once you, first step, stay away from urges. You don't want to try to get the urges. So we need to Harchek Mishachein Ra. You have to stay far away. Create boundaries where you don't have the Yetzer Hara knocking on your door at all points in time, creating these urges with you. And it applies to so many different things. Try to stay away from those urges as much as possible. But you can't always do anything. You can't always help it. Sometimes the Shachin Ra is there. Sometimes you go to work and the Shachin Ra is there. Sometimes you go out in the street and you have a desire to do some X, Y, or Z thing. So you're going to get that desire. Then what happens when you get the desire? Al titchaber l'rasha. It's not you. Don't fuse your Yetzer Hara and your identity. Just because you have this urge, this thought, you do not have to think that that is me, and you do not have to then go and act on it. Right? This is a hard thing to do, and it takes, you know, in the ACT, you know, protocol, takes sessions and sessions of therapy within, you know, anxiety and depression. Although I did see it, actually, some research that I'm doing is they use this for treat pornography addiction, right? So one of the things that you're it's tough as a psychologist is because nobody in the outside secular world, or not nobody, but it's very hard to think that everything, it's okay, there's nothing wrong with it. So you don't have, there's very little therapy literature on treating pornography, and whether you call it addiction or not is a different story. But there are a few people who are interested in it, besides for Orthodox Jews, and that's Mormons. In therapy. So, in the therapy for treating a problematic pornography. Again, I don't want to call it an addiction yet, because that's a loaded statement to say that it's an addiction. But the Mormons at in BYU do a lot of research on this. So it's actually, they go through the ACT literature. They take the manual, the treatment manual for acceptance and commitment therapy, which has been, you know, proven in studies to work with depression and anxiety, etc. And they've used it on people who have this unhealthy habit of watching pornography. And they use this urge idea. And they say, just because you have the urge to do it doesn't mean you have to do it. And again, you have to work through it. You have to. It takes sessions and sessions and sessions, and they have different metaphors and they have different exercises. We're not going to go into that now as to how you teach this, but this is really important. Al titchaber l'rasha. I think, again, I might be reading too much into this, but I don't think I am. It seems to be it's exactly what he's saying, is that you can't, don't fuse with those urges.
The example of a person can do it. Orthodox person smokes. 24 cigars a day, but for whole Shabbos, he did not smoke.
Yeah.
Right. So, cigarettes is a good metaphor for this. It's where the line between addiction and, you know, where the biology takes over. The act would, I think, say in general, might be harder, but the idea is just because you have the urge even to smoke or to do whatever doesn't mean you have to act on it. Yeah, Morty. Acceptance and commitment therapy. Yeah.
Yeah, the individual has a Yetzer Hara and a Yetzer Tov, and there's a concept of something called a Yetzer Tov Meor. What is that? You have to have the Yetzer Hara and to experience it, and then to confront it, to achieve the Yetzer Tov Meor. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I hear you. Life is a struggle. We're confronted with a lot of things, and we have to work to doing as best as we can. And he finishes off for those who struggle and end up. Let's say you don't succeed, and you do the avera. So he says, "Al titeish mina paranut," means. No, that is not what he says. He says, don't give up hope. Right? You messed up, pick yourself up, try again. Okay? So this is a battle. The battle of the Yetzer Hara is a lifelong, you know, centuries old, you know, millennium. This is a human problem. This is the Torah. Fighting the Yetzer Hara is it. This is not easy. So if you mess up, no matter what the avera is, you pick yourself up and you try again. All right, so I think we're going to stop here. Next week, we're going to be doing Mishnah 8. And yeah, actually, let's decide that now. We're going to bench.